upward, more than 250 feet taller than the rocket that had carried Lovell on his Gemini missions, a colossus lit white by floodlights against an inky black sky. "I don't want you to worry," Lovell said, holding Marilyn's hand. "When we lift off, the rocket is going to tilt. It might even look like it's going to fall over, but that's normal. It's exactly how they designed it. Also, the Earth is going to shake in a different kind of way. That's normal, too." By the morning of December 19th, just 48 hours before liftoff, journalists were swarming at the Houston homes of the astronauts. Valerie and Susan were gracious, smiling for everyone, their hair and makeup done, all of them expressing support and admiration for their husbands. Valerie always wore the same dress for appearances on television, yellow, with a close-fitting waist and knee-length skirt. Her mother noticed and asked her about it. Valerie had to confess, it was the only good dress she owned. Her husband was about to become one of the most famous men in the world, yet he still earned military pay, about $16,000 per year, plus another $16,000 from Life magazine, which went only so far with five children to feed. That night, Valerie decided to slip out of the house with three-year-old Eric to go for some groceries. She stole out the back gate and headed for the garage, but was greeted in her driveway by an ocean of reporters and bursting flashbulbs. The next day, photographs ran across the country showing Eric in his mother's arms, sucking his thumb, along with the caption, "Thumbs up for Dad." Valerie loved the photo, but she knew it meant she would be a captive in her own home from that moment forward. On December 20th, the day before the flight, the Soviets let the world know what they thought about Apollo 8. "It is not important to mankind who will reach the moon first and when he will reach it," said cosmonaut German Titov, the second man ever to orbit Earth. Not many in the Soviet Union were worried. Even with the American countdown clock at T-minus 24 hours, few Soviets believed NASA would be crazy enough to launch. That afternoon, Charles Lindbergh and his wife, Anne Morrow, joined the astronauts in Florida for lunch. Anders suspected the visit to be a public relations stunt arranged by NASA, but he changed his mind after hearing the passion in Lindbergh's questions about Apollo 8. After a few minutes, the four men, and Anne, also a pilot, were immersed in conversation about flying. Not one of the astronauts resented the imposition on his time. By now, there wasn't any sense in cramming more pages from a flight manual or checklist. With 20 hours to go until launch, you either knew your stuff or you didn't. The conversation turned to spacewalking and how it compared to the old barnstorming stunt of wingwalking. The Lindberghs were interested to hear that one's sensation of altitude decreased as one flew higher, until it hardly seemed to register in space, where the familiar scenery that helped people judge distance from the ground all but disappeared, and to learn that in space there was no up or down. The astronauts were equally interested to learn of a conversation Lindbergh once had in the 1930s with Robert Goddard, the father of modern rocket engineering. It was theoretically possible, Goddard had told Lindbergh, to design a rocket powerful enough to reach the moon, but the money required to build it, as much as $1 million, would likely keep such a wonder in the realm of science fiction. The astronauts had a good laugh at that one. Lindbergh performed a back-of-napkin calculation after learning how much fuel the Saturn V required to send Apollo 8 to the moon. "In the first second of your flight," Lindbergh said, "you'll burn more than 10 times as much as I did flying the Spirit of St. Louis all the way from New York to Paris." Later that day, Anders's childhood priest arrived at crew quarters. Father Dennis Barry had come to give Anders, a devout Catholic since childhood, communion. This visit annoyed Borman, who was growing edgier as the hours to launch counted down. The longer Father Barry stayed, the more irritated Borman grew. Finally, Borman snapped, Are you going to take communion every 30 seconds before the flight? Borman asked. No, Frank, he's just visiting, Anders said. Well, then get rid of the guy. Borman was sorry he said it, even sorrier when he saw that his remark had hurt Anders. But he thought the crew didn't need distractions so close to launch. Anders had more visitors coming. One was his thesis advisor and head of the Department of Physics at the Air Force Institute of Technology. The other was the man's brother, who was a Jesuit priest. He considered both to be very good friends. Around sunset, Anders took them to the parking lot outside crew quarters where they all lay back on the hood of a car. By now, the sky had darkened, and the men picked out the slivered crescent of the moon in the sky. Early that evening, his last night on Earth before launch, Lovell sneaked away from crew quarters to visit Marilyn. She'd been at a party, but when Jim called, she hurried away and met him for a rendezvous at the cottage where she and her children were staying. There, he kissed his kids and pulled out a photograph. Taken by one of NASA's unmanned lunar probes, it showed an angular mountain on the moon. It was near the Sea of Tranquility, one of the potential sites Apollo 8 would scout for a future landing mission. I'm going to name it Mount Marilyn, he said. Wake up would be at 2:30 a.m. The astronauts were to eat dinner, then go to sleep. Launch at 7:21 a.m. was just 12 hours away. After the meal, the men called their families to say goodnight and goodbye. Borman spoke first to his boys, then to Susan. Everything's going to be all right, he told her. I'll be perfectly safe. I know, Susan said. Before retiring, Borman knelt by his bedside to pray, the Lord's Prayer, then a request for a successful mission, and finally, that he, Lovell, and Anders do their jobs well. But he couldn't sleep. Not for hours. He and his crew had been given only 4 months to train for the flight, and he was concerned about everyone's ability to perform flawlessly. More than anything, he dreaded the possibility of having to fly the backup mission 10 endless days in Earth orbit if some anomaly was found after launch that spooked NASA into canceling the lunar part of the journey. He did not want to leave Susan a widow and his boys fatherless, but on this account, he didn't worry too much. He believed in the rocket and spacecraft the crew would be flying, and especially in the people who'd built and designed them. As Borman saw it, he would be flying with thousands of the world's best minds aboard. Around midnight, ground crews began to pump each of the three stages of the Saturn V with liquid oxygen, an oxidizer necessary for combustion. Ribbons of white vapor danced as the warm Florida air boiled away drops of the liquid oxygen from vents in the tanks. Fuel was next. 3 weeks earlier, the Saturn V's first stage had been filled with 209,000 gallons of highly refined kerosene. Now, liquid hydrogen was added to the second stage booster, 260,000 gallons. And to the third stage booster, 69,500 gallons. Added to the 437,000 gallons of liquid oxygen in the stages, the fully fueled rocket would hold nearly 1 million gallons of propellant and would weigh 6.2 million pounds, all with the explosive potential of a small nuclear bomb. At 2:36 a.m. on Saturday, December 21, 1968, Deke Slayton knocked on the bedroom doors of the astronauts and told them it was time. The men took hot showers, then walked down the hall for a cursory physical exam. After being pronounced fit by a team of doctors, they made their way to the breakfast room, where they were joined by Slayton, George Lowe, Alan Shepard, astronaut Harrison Schmidt, and two of their three backup crew, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. The third member, Fred Hayes, was working inside the spacecraft, setting dials and switches. In heaping quantities, the astronauts' personal chef served filet mignon and scrambled eggs. Steak and eggs was the traditional send-off meal for astronauts. Toast, coffee, and tea. a deliberately low-residue meal, and the last real hot food that the astronauts would consume for the next 6 days. After breakfast, the crew of Apollo 8 made their way to the suiting room. If astronauts could have flown in 13th-century chainmail, they might have preferred it to NASA's spacesuit. All of them, however, understood its necessity. The custom-tailored one-piece suits could be pressurized, and they were made fireproof by Teflon cloth. Layers of Mylar, Dacron, and Kapton protected from heat, while other layers provided cooling and controlled pressure. In all, these suits contained more than 20 layers of protective materials, enough to do battle with a universe that becomes hostile to humans just a few miles above Earth's surface. Fully dressed, the suit's wearer looked like a futuristic version of the Michelin Man and walked a bit like Frankenstein's monster. But the suit could be his lifeline during a spaceflight if the cabin lost pressure. A team of technicians, dressed in surgical masks to avoid spreading germs, descended on the astronauts, ordering them into their long johns and biometric sensors to transmit physiological data to Houston, then helping them don their suits. Borman's equipment specialist would be Joe Schmidt, an all-around good guy, and the same sergeant who'd helped him into his pressure suit so many times at Edwards Air Force Base, where Borman had been a test pilot. The two were old hands at this kind of dance. To enter the spacesuit, Borman had to shimmy and shake his way in through a tight zipper opening in the back of the garment, favoring no limb over any other lest the rest of him be left behind. After he popped his head through the neck ring, oxygen and cooling hoses were attached to blue input and red output valves at his torso. The next piece went on easily. A soft cap, like the ones worn in the 1930s by barnstorming pilots. The men who gave rides to kids like Borman, Lovell, and Anders. NASA's caps, however, were woven with state-of-the-art communications gear. No yelling above the wind required. Gloves were affixed and secured. Finally, a transparent bubble helmet was attached to the neck ring. Borman's head was so large that his helmet cost an extra $45,000 to build. Now, fully kitted up with pure oxygen flowing into their suits from portable ventilators, Borman, Lovell, and Anders were already separated from Earth. The only three men on the planet who needed the planet no more. On the way out of the suiting room, Lovell's technician gave him a pocket handkerchief to dress up his spacesuit, while Schmidt presented Borman with a small paper Christmas tree. The gifts weren't intended to be brought on board, but it was the thought that counted. Carrying their briefcase-sized oxygen ventilators, the crew of Apollo 8 lumbered down a long hallway, waving to a photographer as they made their way to the elevator that would carry them to the building's exit. Television cameras and a small group of well-wishers greeted them as they left the manned spacecraft operations building and boarded the astronaut transport van for the first leg of their journey, an 8-mile ride to the launch pad. Emblazoned on the van's inside door was the figure eight insignia Lovell had designed for this mission, along with a reminder in bold red letters, "No smoking." As the van made its way to the pad around 4:30 a.m., a NASA official drove Marilyn Lovell and her four children to a sand dune about 3 miles from the launch site, the closest NASA allowed observers to be for liftoff. The family were alone when they arrived, except for the coffee and donuts NASA had waiting for them. It was still dark. Marilyn pulled a pack of Pall Malls from her purse. Often she and Susan Borman met in the mornings for a cup of coffee and a smoke, but Marilyn was solo today, so she shook a cigarette loose and lit up by herself. In Houston, the Borman and Anders families began to wake and get ready for a day glued to their televisions. Upon reaching Pad 39A, the astronauts exited the van and bent backwards, straining in their suits and helmets to get a view of the behemoth before them. From a distance of just a few yards, the Saturn V was mythically tall. The idea that it could move, never mind fly, seemed impossible from up close. The astronauts walked to the middle of the launch pad, then boarded a small service elevator built into the crisscrossed steel beams of the service tower, which carried them 32 stories into the air. Then they walked across an access arm to a small loading area where technicians would make a final check of the spacesuits. From there, it was a short walk for the astronauts across a small metal bridge and into the spacecraft. It was 4:58 a.m., still dark outside. From his vantage point, Lovell couldn't help but think of the old astronaut joke. How does it feel to sit atop a vehicle built by the lowest bidder? A NASA staffer gave the signal for the astronauts to start loading. Borman went first and, after some maneuvering, settled into the left-hand seat of the command module, lying flat on his back, as an airline pilot would if his airplane were tipped back onto its tail. A technician gave Anders a hug, then sent him, too, into the spacecraft, where he took the right-hand seat in the small cabin. As Anders worked to get himself settled, Lovell looked down to the ground, 320 feet below. He could see the lights of the press corps as they arrived at their designated sites, and all of a sudden, it hit him. These NASA people are serious. They're going to send us to the moon. My God, we really are doing this. He took a deep breath, then walked across the bridge, put his feet through the hatch of the spacecraft, and lowered himself into the seat between Borman and Anders. Technicians closed and secured the hatch on the Apollo 8 spacecraft at 5:34 a.m. Inside the cabin, the countdown clock read T-minus 2 hours, 17 minutes, and counting. Lying flat on their backs, there wasn't much the crew could do to help things along. Borman wished NASA could just get the damn thing into the air, but knowing that wasn't possible, he wished for something more realistic, that the launch would actually occur. He didn't want another episode such as John Glenn endured in the Mercury days, when his flight was scrapped with 29 minutes to go. If a guy was going to suit up and climb aboard with his nerves on edge, the least a rocket could do was go up. In the command centers at the Cape and in Houston, controllers took their places, settling into legacy aromas of stale pizza and burnt coffee, checking their consoles and lists, and running through their responsibilities as they had done for the past 4 months in their offices, at dinner with their families, in bed after their wives had fallen asleep. The Cape would be in charge of the launch, since they would be on scene, then turn over command to Houston shortly after liftoff. Both command centers vibrated as hundreds of controllers moved into position. At the helm would be Flight Director Cliff Charlesworth, in charge of the flight from the ground. Charlesworth could take any action he deemed necessary to ensure the safety of the crew and the success of the mission. The Capcom, always a fellow astronaut, would do most of the communicating with the crew of the spacecraft as it flew, and he would be the crew's advocate in mission control. The facility would operate around the clock in 8-hour shifts, as long as the mission lasted. Each team of flight controllers was designated by a color. The primary Capcom, Mike Collins, was on Charlesworth's green team, and would cover launch through to the historic TLI maneuver. Overseeing them all in Houston would be Chris Kraft, the director of flight operations. Even now, Kraft might have been the most nervous of them all. He'd been with NASA since its inception in 1958. More than anyone else, he knew how much could go right and wrong when men left Earth. The astronauts occupied themselves by checking switches, confirming checklists, and eavesdropping through their headsets on launch personnel. They could not hear NASA Public Affairs Officer Jack King, whose baritone voice and slight Boston accent had kept the world updated live on launch countdowns since the Mercury flights. Borman, Lovell, and Anders shivered in their spacesuits, their cabin freezing in the still, chilly morning air. The astronauts could do little more than wait. Through a tiny porthole in front of him, Borman watched two seagulls flying around the spacecraft and checking out the strange, tall bird, the Saturn V, that now shared their sky. From his middle seat, Lovell scanned the instrument panel and admired the detail of the Apollo simulators. Nothing inside the command module looked or felt different from what the crew had practiced with on the ground. And in a testament to the cool that runs through the bloodstream of fighter pilots, Anders fell asleep, ready to awaken when things got good. By 7 a.m., network coverage of the launch had gone live on televisions and radios across America and the world. As the countdown clock ticked under an hour, a crowd gathered around the color television in the living room of the Borman home. Susan, her two sons, Frank's parents, who had arrived at 3 a.m. and now fidgeted nervously on the couch, and family friends had come to watch the launch. Joining them were a Life magazine photographer, along with the wives of seven other astronauts, some of whom had brought deviled eggs and champagne. Though she smiled for newspaper photographers while scratching the tummy of the family's shaggy dog, Teddy, Susan's insides were in knots. At every chance, she hurried back to the squawk boxes NASA had installed in her home so that she could listen directly to the communications between Apollo 8 and Mission Control. At the Anders home, Valerie scrambled to round up her five children, seating them atop the toy box in the playroom where the family kept their new color TV. Joining them were Bill's aunt and uncle, several family friends, and the wives of some of the other astronauts. Bill's parents were at home in San Diego to watch the launch. Valerie tried to stay in the moment, absorbing everything, even the fear, full of hope. Among those watching the countdown from behind a giant window at the Launch Control Center at the Cape was backup crew member Neil Armstrong, who couldn't get over the moxie NASA had shown in conceiving the mission. The Saturn V had never been flown with men aboard and had suffered profound problems on its second and most recent test. To put a crew on that rocket now and to point that crew at the moon seemed astonishingly aggressive and wonderful to him. Just 20 minutes remained until launch. For miles along the Cape, thousands of cars and motorcycles and buses and campers jammed the beaches and roadways, a quarter of a million people standing on hoods or in sand or on one another's shoulders, craning their necks for a view of the rocket, passing binoculars back and forth, checking their watches every few seconds. An 80-year-old woman from South Dakota who'd traveled in her son's trailer to witness the launch said, "Those men, what they will do, and I have lived to see it. I am still alive to see it." T-minus 7 minutes, 30 seconds and counting, still aiming toward our planned liftoff time, King told a riveted nation. In the morning light, the view from the spacecraft became clearer. For several minutes, Anders watched a mud dauber wasp build a nest on the capsule window. At T-minus 5 minutes, the access arm and loading area pulled away from the spacecraft and retracted. At Mission Control in Houston, Chris Kraft stared at a giant color screen that was broadcasting a view of the spacecraft. He had always considered launch to be the riskiest part of manned spaceflight, and that was true even with proven rockets. Now, feeling scared to death, he watched as his agency prepared to catapult three good men from the planet aboard the most powerful machine ever built, despite the fact that this machine had never lifted a living thing, not even a mealworm, off the ground. At T-minus 3 minutes, 6 seconds, computers took over full checkout of the rocket. In the Borman and Anders homes, hands were squeezed tight. On the sand dune, Marilyn Lovell huddled with her children. Photographers from various media outlets were stationed with all three families, pressing shutter buttons and swapping film rolls as fast as they could, desperate not to miss a moment. In Mission Control, Flight Director Cliff Charlesworth and Capcom Mike Collins watched the monitors. George Lowe, the man who'd conceived a mission the Soviets still didn't believe would fly, breathed deeply as the clock showed just 1 minute remaining. At T-minus 60 seconds, all three stages of the Saturn V were fully pressurized. 20 seconds, Jack King announced to the world. We are still go at this time. Storms of white vapor began to billow near the base of the rocket, liquid oxygen boiling off during the Saturn V's final moments on Earth. Inside the spacecraft, Borman felt the rocket sway a bit in the wind. T-minus 15, King called. 14, 13, 12, 11, 10. Heart pounding, Borman's left hand remained gripping one of the spacecraft's controls, ready to twist it to the left and abort the mission in case of a catastrophic problem. The three men listened to propellant pumping through the engine manifolds. On the beach, Marilyn reminded herself that the rocket would lean when it took off, just as Jim had warned. 9. We have ignition sequence start. The engines are armed, King said, as a fury of orange-yellow flames lit beneath the rocket and exploded against the launch pad. 4. 3. Flames spread from beneath the rocket and erupted out to the sides. A typhoon of fire awakened and screaming as the ground began to shake. 2. A man-made thunder crashed into people and windows and buildings for miles around. 1. Borman loosened his grip on the abort handle. He would have rather died than twisted by accident in the violence unfolding beneath him. 0. We have commit. We have. King paused for a moment as if he didn't quite believe what he was seeing. Susan Borman, Marilyn Lovell, and Valerie Anders didn't breathe. At 7:51 a.m., King called it. We have liftoff. And Apollo 8 began to move. Chapter 12. Leaving Home. Apollo 8 strained to separate from Earth. Explosions of smoke and fire channeled to the sides of the launch pad by a massive, wedge-shaped flame deflector designed to prevent the fire from rebounding back up into the rocket. 4 hold-down arms held the rocket in place, waiting for the Saturn V's engines to attain perfect, proper thrust. A fraction of a second later, these arms released to allow the machine to ascend. 5 swing arms, each weighing more than 20 tons, remained for a split second longer with their connections to the rocket intact. As the Saturn V began to rise, they too withdrew, and the 6.5 million pound beast broke free from its bonds. A half inch off the pad, it was already too late for the rocket to settle back safely if something went wrong. System design would not allow shutdown of the engines for 30 seconds, even in the event of catastrophic failure, since this would cause the Saturn V to fall back onto the launch pad and explode. If there was any major failure now, Borman would have to twist the abort handle and allow the rocket-propelled escape tower at the top of the spacecraft to pull the command module free and hurtle them out to sea. There was no failure. Each engine was erupting and functioning just as von Braun had envisioned, producing a combined 7.6 million pounds of thrust, or 160 million horsepower. Enough energy to power the entire United Kingdom at peak usage time, as the rocket began to inch upward. Blocks of ice formed by the supercool liquid oxygen in the rocket's first stage shook free from the Saturn's torso and splintered into a white confetti that rained into the firestorm below. A few feet off the pad, the Saturn V began to lean away from the support tower. This was the maneuver Lovell had described to Marilyn, designed to keep the vehicle safe from wind gusts that might throw it back into the tower. Down the nearby beaches, the ground began to shake, and people's chests were pounded by the pressure waves, and it spread out at the speed of sound for miles around the Cape. Inside the command module, the noise had already become deafening for the astronauts, their headsets rendered useless for communicating with the Cape or with one another. Borman and Lovell could sense the slowness of the acceleration due to the sheer weight of the Saturn V, a much different kind of movement than they'd experienced from the nimble Titan II rocket that had powered the Gemini program just 2 years earlier. But it wasn't just the speed that was different. The cabin shook so violently that Anders believed the rocket's fins were grinding through the girders of the launch tower and being shorn off. He tried to find an instrument or a gauge to monitor, something that would confirm the disaster unfolding beneath him, but his head was being shaken with such force he couldn't focus or even think, and even if he could have, he never could have communicated any information to Borman, either by speaking or signaling, since he was no longer in control of his body, and his arms had turned to lead. None of this had been predicted or simulated. In the mountains of books and reams of paper, no one had mentioned that even before the rocket cleared the tower, the world inside it would be coming apart. "Holy shit," Anders managed to think as the bodies of the three astronauts were ragdolled against their straps. "What the hell is going on?" And the rocket still hadn't cleared the launch tower. Groaning under its own weight, the Saturn V began to move higher, bending farther away from the tower as the spitting tail of flame grew longer. The flight was now just 10 seconds old, but Anders already felt like a rat in the jaws of a giant, angry terrier, helpless to do anything but hang on and breathe while the five massive F1 engines constantly swiveled their thrust to keep the 363-foot rocket from toppling over. Again, Anders tried to pick out instruments to get an idea of what was happening, but the rocket kept thrashing him into Lovell, against the wall, into his straps. The crew had trained for hundreds of hours for every kind of emergency, but NASA's simulators were not the kind of dynamic multi-axis machines that could come close to approximating such violence. If an engine had fallen off or exploded, if the rocket had been engulfed in flames, if any number of disasters had been unfolding, the crew wouldn't have known about it, and they wouldn't have been able to hear Mission Control tell them about it either. Still, Borman kept his hand clear of the abort handle. To Anders, it seemed that the flight had already lasted an hour when he and his crewmates heard the first faint transmission in their headphones. A call from the launch operations manager at the Cape that conveyed a simple but essential piece of information. Tower clear. The call had come 13 seconds into the flight. At home, Borman's 17-year-old son, Fred, watched on TV. He'd never known anyone as committed to his work as his father, a man he still saw as a fighter pilot at Edwards Air Force Base, a man who refused to crash in machines that crashed all the time. So Fred was calm today as the rocket climbed, just as he had been during Gemini 7, just as he had been every time there had been sirens and black smoke in the sky at Edwards.
"Just keep going, Dad," Fred thought. "If you just keep doing that, everything's going to be fine."
Borman radioed back to Houston, which had just assumed command from the Cape now that the tower was clear. His voice quaked along with the rocket. "Roll and pitch program." He was confirming that the vehicle was turning to head out to sea exactly as required.
"Roger," answered Capcom Mike Collins.
The punishing cacophony began to diminish as a seagull, the same one Borman had seen before liftoff, flew past the ripples of sound and smoke made by the rocket.
"How do you hear me, Houston?" Borman asked.
"Loud and clear," Collins answered.
Apollo 8 climbed higher, riding a column of fire into a brilliant blue sky. In Houston, controllers watched for any sign of catastrophe, ready to relay abort instructions to Borman, but all they saw were solid reports from their consoles. Inside the spacecraft, Anders could feel the ride smoothing out, and while he hoped the rocket's fins hadn't been ripped off by the tower, he figured he was probably okay given that, by all indications, he was still alive.
"My God," he thought. "If we missed that in our training, what else have we missed?"
Around the world, millions watched as the rocket pushed higher into the sky. In Houston, Susan Borman forgot for a moment that Frank was going to die on the flight. Instead, she sat, still, in her fancy, cream-colored dress, with a string of pearls around her neck, knees up against her chest, hands clasped, awestruck. To her, seeing Apollo 8 launch was like watching the Empire State Building leave Earth. The Saturn's engines continued to burn 15 tons of propellant per second. Even as the ride smoothed, G-forces built inside the cabin, pinning the crew against their seats. Every movement and adjustment by the rocket was pre-programmed and executed by the Saturn's onboard computer, so the crew could do little more than study the readouts on their instrument panels, watching the rocket's velocity climb and the countdown grow closer to the end of the Saturn's first stage. On nearby beaches, people watching the rocket ascend stood on cars and cheered and waved American flags. One of them was Lovell's 15-year-old daughter, Barbara, who felt as if the Earth was cracking beneath her from the rocket's shockwaves. 1 minute into the flight, Apollo 8 reached the speed of sound, 767 miles per hour, and an altitude of about 24,000 feet. At that point, the roar and crackle generated by the interaction between engine exhaust and air could not move fast enough to catch up to the spacecraft, and the cabin grew quiet. The hum of its instrument panel, the only noise Borman could detect. To him, it now sounded as if he was flying an unpowered glider. Outside, the Saturn V's first stage engines still burned furiously as the rocket continued to gain speed as it rose and arced out to sea. In less than 20 seconds, the vehicle would reach a state known as Max Q, the moment at which an airframe is subjected to maximum aerodynamic pressure. At Mission Control in Houston, Kraft felt his stomach twist. For months, he'd worried about the effects of Max Q on Apollo 8. It happened about 1 minute and 19 seconds into the flight at an altitude of 44,062 feet and a speed of about 1,500 miles per hour. The Saturn's five engines bellowed flames, still visible to spectators up and down the Florida coast. In the press area, television cameras were now angled almost vertically on their tripods. If the ship was going to break apart, now was a likely time for it. But Apollo 8 passed this stress test and continued to soar into the sky. The spacecraft now gained speed and altitude fast. 2 minutes into the flight, it was traveling at 3,300 miles per hour and was 100,000 feet above Earth. Here, the atmosphere had grown so thin that the rocket faced little risk of disaster caused by aerodynamic stress. But the next hurdle awaited. In less than a minute, the propellant for the first stage engines would run out. At that point, the stage would have to be severed and allowed to fall away from the ship. The engines continued to burn staggering amounts of propellant, causing the ship to grow lighter and G-forces to increase, pressing the astronauts into their seats with up to four times the force of gravity on Earth, making each man's arm feel as if it weighed about 36 pounds. At an altitude of about 215,000 feet, the spacecraft reached a speed of 4,236 miles per hour. With the onboard clock nearing 2.5 minutes elapsed time, the first stage shut down, explosives fired, then retro rockets ignited, separating the first stage from the rest of the Saturn V and enveloping all of Apollo 8 in a cocoon of fire. To many of those watching from the ground and on television, it appeared that the entire ship had exploded, but it was just the precursor to the first stage falling back toward the Atlantic, glowing a brilliant goodbye. Inside the spacecraft, the sudden shutdown of the first stage caused G-forces to drop from 4 to 0 almost instantly. Having been severely compressed, the 363-foot tower of aluminum alloy suddenly sprang back, flinging the astronauts forward with explosive force. By instinct, Anders threw up his hand in front of his face to prevent being catapulted through the instrument panel, but by that time, the five J2 engines of the second stage had kicked in, and the acceleration threw Anders's outstretched hand back so hard against his head that the wrist ring on his glove carved a gouge in his helmet. As with the launch itself, simulations hadn't come close to preparing the astronauts for the violence of this moment. Pinned back once again by the force of five screaming engines, the crew began to check instruments to make sure all was okay. Out of the corner of his eye, Anders glanced to check whether Bormann or Lovell had noticed the gouge in his helmet, the sure mark of a rookie astronaut. Thankfully, it seemed they hadn't. A few seconds after the first stage booster fell away, Bormann prepared to get rid of the other end of the vehicle. The 34-foot-tall spire-shaped escape tower and conical boost protective cover, which had ridden atop Apollo 8, poised to rocket the command module away from the Saturn V in case of emergency. Cutting it loose meant a great saving in weight. If an abort was necessary after losing the escape tower, the crew would use propulsion systems built into the command and service modules to separate from the Saturn V, redirect their course, and ride the command module back to splashdown. Bormann threw a switch, causing a small rocket motor to jettison the escape tower. Instantly, the cabin was awash in sunlight, its five windows no longer obstructed by the boost protective cover. Now, at an altitude of 300,000 feet, the astronauts could see the curvature of Earth against a blue sky that melded into the deep purple-black of onrushing outer space. 2 minutes later, Apollo 8 reached 100 miles altitude as it arced almost horizontally over Earth. The ship was now 350 miles downrange of Cape Kennedy and just about high enough for its planned Earth orbit. Speed, however, was another matter. To achieve orbit, the spacecraft needed to reach approximately 17,425 miles per hour. Anything less, and Earth's gravity would pull it back down. At the moment, 6 minutes into the flight, it was traveling only 10,000 miles per hour. Apollo 8 needed a big push, and that was the job of the five second-stage engines. Bormann could see indicators of the ship's speed galloping forward on a five-digit readout on the instrument panel. If the Saturn's second stage failed now, the crew could use the rocket's single third-stage engine to get them to orbital speed. But if that happened, they wouldn't have enough propellant left to send the spacecraft on to the moon, and Apollo 8 would become a days-long Earth orbital checkout mission. That was the scenario Bormann dreaded. So far, however, the second stage booster was flying true and smooth as it pushed the spacecraft's speed from 10,000 to 14,000 miles per hour in just 2 minutes' time. The five engines needed to burn for only another 45 seconds before falling off and giving way to the third stage. Even for a conservative pilot like Bormann, those 45 seconds seemed a near certainty now. And then, he felt something go wrong. The rocket beneath him started to shake furiously. A pogo. A problem similar to the one that had afflicted the unmanned Apollo 6 on the Saturn V's second and most recent test flight. Stresses created by pogo could damage or even tear apart the rocket. Von Braun and his engineers believed they'd worked out the issue, but this was exactly the kind of thing no one could know for certain without making another test flight. And there hadn't been another test flight after Apollo 6. As a long-time fighter pilot and test pilot, Bormann didn't spook easily. Now, he was concerned. But there was nothing for the crew to do now except hope that the Saturn V could endure the pogo for another 40 seconds until the second stage burned itself out and separated from the vehicle. The ship continued to shake, even as it gained speed by hundreds of miles per hour every few seconds. With just 9 seconds to go before the engines of the second stage were to cut off, Bormann radioed to Collins in Houston. "The pogo's damping out." Collins barely had time to respond before the engines shut down as scheduled, and the Saturn's second stage separated from Apollo 8 and began its long fall back to Earth, where its remains would sink into the Atlantic, just as the first stage had. A fraction of a second later, the Saturn's third stage, the S-4B, kicked in, creating a flash Borman could see through the hatch window. In just 3 seconds, it attained full thrust, but the push was almost gentle compared to those of the first two stages, as the rocket no longer needed to overcome air resistance and was using just a single J-2 engine, which itself was less prone to vibration. Despite the pogo episode, Borman remained impressed by the beauty of the rocket's engineering. In a matter of moments, the spacecraft passed over Bermuda and reached 95% of the velocity needed for Earth orbit. If all went well, it would take just over a minute to add the last 5% needed to give Apollo 8 enough speed to achieve that almost mystical equilibrium between falling back to Earth and flying off into endless space. By now, the stack that comprised Apollo 8 was barely one-third as long as it had been at launch, and millions of pounds lighter. Driving this relative featherweight, the single third-stage engine pushed the spacecraft even faster, to a speed of 17,425 miles per hour, before cutting out 11 minutes and 25 seconds into the flight. Moments later, Apollo 8 was in orbit around Earth. In Houston, Kraft, Collins, and rows of others exhaled. This was the first time the Saturn V had been asked to deliver men into space, and it had succeeded. The Saturn's third stage had worked beautifully, but unlike the previous two stages, it did not separate from the spacecraft. It would be needed again, in about 2 hours and 40 minutes, this time to send Borman, Lovell, and Anders to the moon. Apollo 8 settled into an easy orbit around Earth. It would circle the planet every 88 minutes and 10 seconds, with a perigee, closest point to Earth, of 113 miles, and an apogee, farthest point from Earth, of 119 miles. With no more external forces pushing them forward, the astronauts experienced weightlessness inside the cabin. Borman and Lovell were old hands with the sensation, which was caused not by a lack of gravity, but by being in the constant free fall that is orbit. Anders couldn't wait to give it a go. But it wasn't time to unstrap yet. Apollo 8 was in a parking orbit around Earth for a reason. To allow the crew and controllers to confirm the proper function of the spacecraft's systems and hardware. Only if all looked flawless would Borman, Lovell, and Anders be allowed to leave the planet. While the astronauts checked their spacecraft, their wives met the press back on Earth. Standing on her front lawn, still wearing pearls and with her hair in a perfect blonde flip, Susan Borman told reporters, "This is very much different from Gemini 7. The magnitude of this entire thing is very difficult to comprehend and hasn't sunk in on me. I've always been known as a person who had something to say. Today, I am speechless. I'm too emotionally drained to talk." Nearby, a tearful Valerie Anders, wearing a bright yellow raincoat and black patent leather shoes, told the press that no one had spoken in her home during liftoff. "It was beautiful and it has remained beautiful," she said. When the interviews concluded, the women returned to their squawk boxes to continue following their husbands. After Susan closed her front door, she told a guest, "I don't know if I can sit here for the next 2 hours." She lit a cigarette. She'd made a solemn resolution to quit as soon as Frank returned from the moon. The astronauts had just over 2.5 hours to check out the spacecraft and its systems, less than 2 full revolutions around Earth, so they needed to make every minute count. Borman knew that Anders, a rookie, would be tempted to steal glances out the window and had taken to warning him during training not to try it during this critical time. When Borman glanced to his right, he saw Anders hard at work checking systems. It took Anders a full 3 or 4 seconds after that to begin peeking out his window. A few moments later, Borman and Lovell were looking too. And there was Earth.
a kaleidoscope of color turning in a black sky. Swirling cotton-white clouds revealed brilliant blue oceans beneath their breaks, while brown and green stretches of forest and jungle covered entire countries. Thin bands of blue followed the curvature of Earth, an incandescent skin of atmosphere come alive in a sea of darkness. Just a portion of the full sphere could be seen at this altitude of 116 miles, but already the astronauts could pick out the outlines of continents. The three men checked and rechecked the spacecraft's switches, dials, buttons, readouts, valves, circuit breakers. They confirmed that the command module's maneuvering system was operational and healthy. They would need it for re-entry to Earth's atmosphere on the return trip from the moon. And they verified that the spacecraft's critical systems, including electrical and environmental, for oxygen, cooling of electronics, and temperature, were working perfectly. Around 17 minutes into the flight, Lovell was the first to unstrap and leave his seat. He headed to the lower equipment bay to use the spacecraft's optics to make sightings of the stars. This would refine the guidance system's determination of direction. Throughout the mission, ground engineers would use the radio signal to the spacecraft to work out where Apollo 8 was and where it was going. If the radio equipment failed, Lovell would be the one in charge of getting Apollo 8 to the moon and back to Earth. He would spend a lot of time at this optics station practicing the use of the spacecraft's sextant and telescope to measure the angles between stars and the horizon of Earth or the moon. For centuries, sailing ships had navigated by using sextants to make similar measurements. Even in the space age, it was hard to improve on these ancient techniques. This was Lovell's first chance to give the system a go. He felt nauseated almost immediately. That hadn't been a problem during his Gemini flights, but the Apollo spacecraft was much larger and gave him more opportunity to turn his head and move around, a likely cause of his queasy feeling. He warned his crewmates, "Don't turn your heads when you first leave your seats," then steadied himself and allowed it to pass. Near 25 minutes into the flight, after all was confirmed to be operating smoothly, the crew were allowed to remove their helmets and gloves. Doing so would help them move about the cabin and check the various switches and systems. A few minutes later, Anders got out of his straps and left his seat. For the first time, he was experiencing weightlessness. "Hey, it's like sitting on an ice rink, isn't it?" he said to his crewmates. Despite their liberation, the crew still needed to stay in their suits. Anders gestured to the others to hand him their helmets so he could stow them. He was surprised to see that each one had a gouge, just like the one he'd made when trying to protect his face during the violent shutdown of the rocket's first stage. "I guess we're all rookies on a Saturn V," he thought. 45 minutes into the flight, Apollo 8 approached darkness for the first time as it moved eastward at more than 17,000 miles per hour, closing in on the side of the planet where it was currently nighttime. Outside the cabin windows, the crew could see lightning flashes from a storm down below, as if 1,000 paparazzi had gathered to take pictures of them from the clouds. They were still looking when Lovell called out into the cabin. "Oh, shoot. What was that?" Borman asked. "My life jacket." The astronauts all wore life vests over their suits, in case the spacecraft had to bail out over the Atlantic during launch. Lovell had caught his on something, and it had inflated with carbon dioxide. The vest had earned its nickname, Mae West, after the buxom Hollywood starlet. Even as Borman and Anders smiled, everyone knew they had a problem. Inflated, the Mae West took up space in a cabin where every square inch counted. Deflating it, however, would release levels of carbon dioxide that might be too much for the environmental control system to remove, and that might prove harmful to the crew. Borman wasn't angry at Lovell, just irritated, and he'd have been irritated at himself if he'd done it.
The challenge now was to figure out a solution. Anders hit on one a few seconds later, an answer of old-school simplicity. When the crew got a chance, they would deflate the vest through the urine dump, the same valve through which they got rid of liquid bodily waste. For now, they simply tied it down and got on with their work. About 90 minutes into the flight, Apollo 8 passed over the Pacific Ocean toward Southern California. Out his window, Anders stole a glimpse of Los Angeles, picking out Santa Monica and Pacific Palisades, and then his hometown of San Diego, and the beaches where he first met Valerie. He felt a moment's envy. Borman and Lovell had enjoyed these spectacular rolling views for 2 weeks aboard Gemini 7. For Anders, the view would last for just another 80 minutes. Officially, he wasn't even supposed to be looking. Anders checked to make sure Borman wasn't watching, then stole a long glance out the window and let it settle into his memory. It took Apollo 8 less than 11 minutes more to cross the United States. In Houston, Flight Director Cliff Charlesworth told Mission Control that the S-4B, the Saturn's third stage booster, looked good for translunar injection, the maneuver that would propel the spacecraft out of its orbit around Earth and onto the moon. To pull it off, Apollo 8 needed to accelerate from its current speed of about 17,400 miles per hour to nearly 24,250 miles per hour. That boost would be accomplished by the single J2 engine on the Saturn's third stage, which would be reignited and burned for nearly 6 minutes. Doing this would not, as many believed, cause the spacecraft to leave Earth orbit. Rather, it would simply change the shape of Apollo 8's orbit around Earth from a near circle into a highly elongated ellipse, one that would stretch all the way from Earth to the moon and back. The exact moment of the engine's firing, as well as its thrust, direction, and duration, depended on complex mathematics designed to put the spacecraft at just the right point where it could slingshot around the far side of the moon and make a free return to Earth if necessary, all while accounting for the movements of Earth, the moon, and the spacecraft itself. Row after row of controllers in Houston, in shirt sleeves and ties, seated at consoles crowded with monitors, buttons, levers, and dials, needed to analyze data pouring in from the spacecraft, trying to determine whether Apollo 8 looked ready to go to the moon. "How does it feel up there?" Collins radioed to the crew. "Very good, very good," Borman replied. "Everything is going rather well. The Earth looks just about the same way it did 3 years ago." Mission Control got a kick out of that one. Meanwhile, in Hawaii, NASA had made it known that the translunar injection burn would occur almost directly over the islands. If the night stayed clear, locals might see Apollo 8's third stage engine ignite as it hurled the spacecraft toward the moon. Just 25 minutes remained before the scheduled burn. Borman could picture Chris Kraft as he prepared for the historic maneuver, chewing on a stale cigar, watching a console over a controller's shoulder, processing the flood of information pouring in. Even now, no matter how far along things were, no matter how many things kept going right on board, Borman still couldn't quite accept that Kraft or Flight Director Charlesworth would really go through with this. As Borman began to stow equipment, Charlesworth put out his Lucky Strike cigarette and began to call the roll, going console by console to ask his men at Mission Control for a go or no-go verdict on translunar injection. One by one, they gave him the same answer. Go. Charlesworth looked to Capcom Collins. It was up to Collins to pass along Houston's decision to Apollo 8. For the first time, mankind was about to leave its home planet in search of a new world. To Collins, a man to whom history mattered, the event required words worthy of the moment, a statement that not only captured this cutting of the cosmic umbilical cord, but would remind future generations that humankind understood the magnitude of what it was about to attempt. He radioed the spacecraft.
Apollo 8, Houston?
Go ahead, Houston, Borman replied.
Apollo 8, you are go for TLI. Over.